I'm opening.
We have
an eye, sort of a nostril, two teeth. One of the teeth has a small cavity.
Close call, folks, but I think we got here just in time.
Presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro. This is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin.
Welcome back, everybody, to Anatomy of a Movie, part of the Popcorn Talk Network. Today we are talking about the American film, American Sniper. I am your host, Marissa Serafini. Joining me, I have...
Hi, guys. This is Sarah Stratton.
And hello, everybody. It's Dimitri.
Okay, what did we think of this film? Very intense. Clint Eastwood, another remarkable movie from him, I think.
Well, I think that I saw this movie, it seems, rather late in the game, because people were flocking to this from its limited release. So I feel it hasn't been out that long, but I already feel like I'm on the tail end of watching it, because so many people have seen this movie. I was a little bit nervous going in, just because in the past couple years, there's been really bit, like, there's been some very, like, A-list, well-made war movies that you hear a lot about, and then I've gone into them and not liked them as much as other people, to name a few. Let's see. Hurt Locker. Huge Oscar push. Huge critical acclaim. I was like, I'm going to watch this. I think I'm going to love it.
Huge Oscar push. It won the Oscar for Best Picture.
But and Best Director.
Yeah, I got Best Director. Like, there was so much talk around it. And I saw it, and I fell asleep in that movie. I tried to watch it three times. It took me three times to complete it. So I was like, okay, here's another war movie.
You mean you went to the theaters three times to watch one movie?
Screener. I saw it, for that one.
Nevertheless, it took a while.
Zero Dark Thirty, watched that one, liked it, didn't need to see it again.
Yeah.
Liked it, though. And then go into last year, I mean, Lone Survivor came out. I really did like Lone Survivor. I had a couple friends who worked on it, so I was really pumped about it in front of him. And so there's been all these movies. Compared to all of them, I actually do like this one best. I mean, I would say Lone Survivor is up there for me, too. But I was really pulled in. I liked the story they told. They spanned, for me, it was really a triumph that Clint was able to tackle so many different scenes of his life in a fluid manner that I wasn't thinking, oh, we're not spending enough time on his childhood. Oh, we're not spending enough time on him being a cowboy. We just covered four tours in a 2-hour movie. Like, and I was like, oh, I felt like he gave each part a really good controlled scene, and that he also put in some through line storytelling that people can debate whether they're fabricated or made too much of because they weren't big in the book. But to me, it kept me entertained. It kept me in the story throughout. And I did follow along his mental journey, and I thought the acting was done really well. So I was really, really happy with that when I came out of this.
All right. Dimitri, how about you?
Yeah, I think this is a really solid film. Politics or apolitics or politico and controversy aside, I mean, I think it's a really solid film. Clint Eastwood went in, did what he does best. He's a very efficient director. And you can tell through this movie, Clint Eastwood is never one to, you know, there's no shaky cam, not an overuse of edits and slow-mo. There was one scene where slow-mo came in, and I was like, oh, he's using slow-mo. But it made sense, and it was towards the end of the movie. So he does a very efficient job. I think he did a really good job. I think this is a solid film. And, you know, I know we'll get more into talking about maybe some of the politics or the apolitics that's been going on and a lot of the discord and all that stuff. But I think as a whole, I think it's pretty decent. I think it's a well done movie. I think it was well filmed, well shot, well acted throughout. It doesn't. One thing that caught me, and I remember a year ago around this time, we did talk about Lone Survivor. And one of the things with me about Lone Survivor is that it's directed by Peter Berg, whose subtlety is not in his vocabulary. You know, every scene of violence you sort of kind of feel in your gut because he just ramps it up and he does it almost exploitive. Clint Eastwood doesn't shoot that way. He never has. And, yeah. You know, he did a really good job. And this was a very violent movie, you know, and it shows the horrors of war and things like that. But I just, I liked his approach throughout.
For me, though, one of the reasons that worked in the difference is between Lone Survivor and this and the fighting style is, for me, it kind of put in that I think war from the perspective of kind of each position is different. And for me, he is a sniper. It is a different viewpoint. Like, when you're in battle, it's different for him than for people who are in the front, like, breaking down doors on foot. Like, I just feel like the mentality is different. Like, they do concentrate on the fact that you do have to be, like, living in between your breath, in between the heartbeats, versus, like, it's not counting, it's keeping that calm. And to me, like, thematically, this fit that, versus in Lone Survivor, when so much of that was, you know, those epic falls down the cliffs where it's shaking, going crazy, because that's what you're going
right, but
for.
Had Peter Berg directed American Sniper, like, heads would have been exploding like melons.
It would have been, like, a completely different story. And also the thing is, with Lone Survivor, that story took place in a matter of hours, in a matter of, like, 1 to 2 days. So that was, like, really constant action throughout that everyone was enduring. And then American Sniper, you have the tours, which lasted for so long, and then you had the break to go back home, and then you go back. So there was a lot of back and forth that spanned over so many years. So we got a lot of action at some moments, and then some calm serenity.
I would argue that the second half of American Sniper plays out almost like an action movie.
I feel and so too, but I feel like American Sniper had more breaks from the action to calm than Lone Survivor did.
With the kind of dual plots of home and away, that it lends itself to that.
Exactly. And war films are always usually tough to digest and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And I admit there's only, like, a handful of war films that I've seen, and, like, all of them usually stick with me. And sticks with me to the point where, like, I'm affected so much that I don't want to see it again. It's so good, but it's like, I don't know if I can handle watching it again.
Oh,
so
totally
they're so intense.
You.
And I feel like American Sniper, I might be able to watch this movie again, but it's so good the first time. I don't know how it'll hit me and affect me watching it more.
Right.
Because it's such an all war movies are intense.
I mean, I agree with you. I don't go watching Saving Private Ryan
All the time. Or Hurt Locker,
right.
Or, you know, any of those type of films.
No, absolutely. Yeah. But I will go watch something like Where Eagles Dare, or Kelly's Hero, that both starred Clint Eastwood. Those are great, like, war. So they're set in the war, but they're, like, either a great action comedy or a great suspense, Alice McLean-ish kind of a movie. Those movies I watch all the time again. But you're right. Like, Private Ryan, I go back every now and then because it's on, like, cable or something.
Yeah.
But I don't, hey, everybody, let's watch Saving Private Ryan. Let's have a fun night at the movies.
These aren't the movies that you jump to. It's like, I have to constantly rewatch it.
Absolutely.
And, you know, you watch it and take it in stride and then get back to it when you feel like it.
Yeah.
And but I think Clint Eastwood is a really good director to take on this type of film, knowing that he has a lot of war films in his background under his belt, and I think he was a perfect guy to direct this.
Yeah, there were parts of this that did remind me a lot of Heartbreak Ridge, which he also directed, and he starred in that one. So again, he has a very efficient way of filming. He works quickly. He likes to end his days early, like, so it's almost like a work week.
He's efficient.
He's very efficient, but to my knowledge, he's always been that way. He understands people have families and they'd like to get back home. So he usually wraps up relatively early, and he meters his shots pretty well. He gets what he wants quickly, and then he's done. And it's very almost matter of fact kind of shooting. He doesn't use a lot of odd, weird camera angles. He doesn't use a lot of different technique. He doesn't use a lot of handheld and shaky cam. You know, last night I watched Unforgiven.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's a great movie, greatly told, but when you look at it, it very much is like a John Ford Western, which it was supposed to be. And he had a little Sergio Leone, but he's very simplistic in his shots. And instead of trying to grab the audience's attention with something weird or crazy angle. He just would rather get the landscape. And I think in American Sniper it works because it did lend a sort of kind of a realism where the sniper is away from the action and he's looking through. I loved all the scenes of the telescope. Like you're looking through a telescope, basically.
Mm-hmm. And his perspective.
Right. So and he's far removed from a lot of what's happening, but he has to be that way. And I enjoyed a lot of those shots. One of my favorite scenes was the sandstorm scene. And again, you could have gone crazy and made that, but it was so simple and effective in the way that it was done that it lent attention to it because you couldn't see where the hell anybody was. So, yeah, it's good stuff.
Yeah, I really liked it. And also, Clint Eastwood wasn't originally the director attached to this film. We had Steven Spielberg, which is very surprising because, I mean, he's Saving Private Ryan. You gotta love that. And so I think Clint Eastwood was a good replacement or a fill-in to take on this role. And also, when the studio went up to Clint Eastwood, he was actually coincidentally reading this book based on Chris Kyle's life during that, and he only had about 30 pages left, and he called the studio the very next day, and he wanted to take it on.
Yeah.
Which is funny to me that Steven Spielberg dropped out because they wouldn't increased the budget enough for him to feel like he could realize this story. And I think that, as we've all said, and as people are critically agreeing with us, that he did accomplish this for the budget, and he did a great job.
Yeah, I think it would have been a different... Well, it definitely not think. Spielberg has come out and saying what he would have done. I think it's a fascinating story. Bradley Cooper was recently on Howard Stern, and he talked about this whole thing. And it was great because Bradley Cooper, who was a producer, he had the rights, he wanted to make this movie. He said Steven Spielberg called him. They wanted to do the movie, and, you know, Bradley Cooper's like, okay, sure, absolutely. Mm-hmm. He goes, that would be fantastic. And Howard Stern, too, was even, he goes, Jesus, how does that make you feel? Like, somebody like Spielberg wants to do your movie. It's like, oh, sitting on top of the world, things didn't work out. And when he got the call, Spielberg called him and said, we can't do this. Not coming to terms and rather things. And I remember Stern being, he goes, oh, you must have been like heartbroken. Like that must have, he goes, yeah, it's just business. He goes, I get it. Then we went on, we get Clint Eastwood, to do it. Again, I agree with you. I think he was a great follow up. Spielberg's version, according to Spielberg, he said, and this would have been an interesting movie. Tell me whether you agree or disagree. Spielberg would have focused, he would have had that Mustafa character in the movie a lot more. He wanted to use the Mustafa character as more of the mirror image of Chris Kyle. Mm-hmm. And so my guess is we probably would have gotten a lot of, from that perspective, he was an Olympian. How does he become a sniper? Mm-hmm. And it would have been an interesting dichotomy to look at. We have, you know, the American guy and then the other guy who's basically doing the same thing. It would have been a different thematic movie, I think.
It's interesting. It's definitely an interesting movie. The funny part of that to me is that Mustafa character has gotten some, not backlash, but some people are saying that they never really were in a rivalry with each other. Like, Mustafa did exist.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And was a very well-known sniper who was very dangerous, killed many people, but it wasn't like they had an exchange going on.
Right. Yeah.
It wasn't that Chris Kyle shot him. This was all added thematically, and I thought a very strong choice because it did tie in all of the four tours together.
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. And I liked that it was just kind of there and was giving you something to follow. But, I mean, if you make Mustafa really the second lead in this versus Sienna Miller, because that's who I feel like you would be replacing.
Yes.
I feel like right now you have Chris Kyle and then it's kind of Sienna Miller's story. And then if you bump Mustafa up, I think you kind of have to you would take a lot of his home and his family away.
Yeah, no, it would have been a different movie.
It's a different parallel. You know. And I think that one of the reasons this got so much attention was because this was a movie that focused on the home life. And focused on what was going on for the family. And if you make it Chris Kyle versus Mustafa, it doesn't come American Sniper, it becomes Two Snipers.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
I agree. And
go ahead.
I felt like had they, increased Mustafa's character, it would have been more. I felt watching this film, Mustafa was just another sniper who was always on the pursuit of Chris Kyle. Not that they had any rivalries or whatnot. It was because it always felt that Chris Kyle was the one who was the better sniper, and Mustafa was constantly just chasing him. And but they didn't build his character enough to be equally matched to Chris. And therefore, you know, shooting Mustafa at the end wouldn't have been as big as a reward because they didn't really build his character that much.
See, I think that they did, because they were saying that this Mustafa character was shooting soldiers. He was like doing a lot of damage, and in a very significant way. Mm-hmm. And then when you add in that there's a bounty on Chris Kyle's head, which I guess didn't really happen. And
oh
again,
no, there was a bounty. It was more around $20,000 than $180,000, although the number did fluctuate. Okay. So who knows?
It goes up with each kill. But in any I thought that the Mustafa character was brought up as a foe, and he was doing as much damage as Chris Kyle was. But the difference, at least the way I saw it, is that where our Chris Kyle character was trying to do his job, but there were times where you saw through Bradley Cooper's performance the gears turning, like, I don't want to put the RPG down, kid. Like, come on. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't do this and whatever. Whereas they showed the Mustafa character took pleasure out of doing what he was doing. And even there was a small glimpse of video being played when Chris was back home. Mm-hmm. And it was videos of this supposedly Mustafa taking out American soldiers. And there was that one where first he kneecapped the guy and then he waited for a bit, and then he shot him again. And there was a little bit of a sadistic thing where at least with Chris Kyle, the way I took it is he had a job to do. He wanted to do his job, but there were certain times where there was a little moral ambiguity.
Yeah, there was more human empathy and sympathy towards everyone that, you know, was being affected. There was more human qualities to...
I felt.
I would agree to everything you said, Dimitri, and like my favorite point of it is that the movie allows you to make those judgments on what is different and what is similar between them, and also this wonderful thread that they attribute to Mustafa's character through his tours. But it's never forced. It's never said, like, you don't have any characters being like, you're the only one who could take Mustafa down because you're true. Like, there's no vocalization of them being like, the two sides of a coin or what.
Well, they did say that. Well, actually, there was a part in the movie where they said, we have to hunt this guy down. Like, there was a part in the movie where they said, we have to hunt him down because he is causing major damage. We need to go after him.
Yes. Yeah. And that was said about the butcher as well. And I felt like that it was more a tactic of war than a, like, you have to, he's your rival.
No, he didn't say perspective. He goes, our mission is we got to go out and find him. Yeah. We got to take him out in one way, shape, or form.
That did happen.
So, you know, I mean, they did set him up, quote, as sort of kind of a villainous character. He was his foe. And again, in the book, apparently he's just mentioned once, if that. And, you know, there's no, even though Chris Kyle made this amazing shot from like a mile away, there's no proof. And even Chris Kyle in the book had said, I don't know whether it was him or not. You know, and the movie makes it a point that it was Mustafa that he killed. But again, that gives a little bit of a catharsis, as you were saying a little bit earlier about, you know, coming in towards the end, and okay, wow, and it's time, and at that point, it's time to go home, time to get out of here.
I thought it was a good tactic for storytelling and for making this picture relatable to the audience. Yeah. I don't think it's too out of line and out of historical context or out of the book. I think it was just really a smart move for how they wrote this script.
Absolutely.
I think so too. And Sarah, you mentioned that had we had more Mustafa, we wouldn't have as much as his wife, Taya. Mm-hmm. And she was a big integral part of the film. And even the real life Taya Kyle, she was a big influence on this film.
Absolutely.
Just being made in the process. Mm-hmm. And I think Sienna Miller did an amazing job portraying her.
She was very good. Mm-hmm.
What did you think, Sarah?
I really liked Sienna Miller. I thought that their relationship was great, very believable. I felt her fall in love with him, and I felt her hurting when he wasn't all there. Just to throw this in, because I think this is probably the best point to bring it up, that I was one of the people who, and in my theater, people laughed out loud at the baby, the prop that they were having, particularly in their fight scenes. I don't know if you guys noticed it. I very much noticed it, and people actually laughed in my theater. They were dealing with this prop baby, and it was just like, you would just very much tell that it was either a doll or a robot, and they're having like a heated conversation, and people like watched this baby move, and people laughed in my theater. It was very distracting to me in their scenes. And I looked it up, and there's people out there who agree with me that that's what they saw too. And I just wanted to point out that it has come out that there was supposed to be a real baby. Real baby number one had a fever. Baby number two did not show. And Clint Eastwood, in his normal let's get through this style, was like, hand me the robot, more or less. And was like, we're getting this done. So besides that fact, like, I thought that their relationship at home was very believable.
Oh, yeah.
I really liked kind of seeing... They kind of gave us a... They gave us a glimpse at all of their fights. Like, for instance, there's the one, I can't remember in between which tours it is, where they're in bed. And she's like, if you don't come back, we might not... If you leave, we might not be here when you get back. And I think it's like either the next... I think it might even be the next scene that it's him basically already over there. Like, we don't get to see the... Okay, go one more time. We don't get to see any resolution. You just kind of know that they had a fight, and then he still decided to go. And you kind of still know she's going to be there when he gets back.
Yeah.
And I liked that it was just these like little glimpses of the issues that they were going through. And it wasn't a full arcing fight each time where we got to the beginning, the middle, and the end of it. It was just constant pressure and something that was both pulling them apart and bringing them together. So I really, really liked... I thought their relationship was very solid throughout the movie.
Yes. Dimitri, did you like the relationship every time that he went away to war? And then even, like, having the conversations over the phone when he's literally in the middle of the action. Mm-hmm. Well, what do we think of that?
Well, yeah, you know, you bring up two good points. Number one, I think that Sienna Miller is, to an extent, she ended up being an extension of the audience because... She was the one who noticed every time Chris came back, he was a little bit different. So we notice him going through this this post-traumatic stress syndrome. In each little way, it just seems something is a little bit more chipped away. Something's a little bit more off. He's a little bit more, you know...
Worn down
and just keeping things inside. He doesn't want to share the atrocities that he's going to. He doesn't feel like there's that scene in the garage... where the gentleman recognizes him, which I thought was a very well-handled scene.
Mm-hmm.
And he sort of was uncomfortable about being called a hero. Mm-hmm. You know, it was his job and all. And I liked when he went home because, yeah, to your points, I thought that it did add that home base. It was, and again, through Sienna Miller, because she obviously noted that this is changing you. And he also... Chris Kyle is played by Bradley Cooper, I thought, who did a really good job. I felt that he was able to put out there that, yes, he was changing mentally. Things were like, he was trying to do his best at saying, I'm doing this to protect my guys. I'm doing this because it's the right thing to do. Where he had factions from all over saying, fuck this war. Fuck this place. This is killing, like, I'm changing it. And he did his best to remain as strong as he possibly could. And you can tell by that fourth when he called, I'm coming home. And so, and each time through Sienna Miller, she saw this too.
Mm-hmm.
And I really liked how they made her a character in which we, the audience, got to see through her eyes because we noticed the change as well. And they played it up really well where the character, Chris Kyle himself, he didn't want to accept the change. Mm-hmm. He didn't want to accept that this was hurting him on the inside with each kill or whatever.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and I like the simplicity of just the phone calls because if you see in the first tour, he's still talking to her during all the action and whatnot. He's still very connected back to home. And then throughout the second and third, he's not really talking to Mateo, like that connection's kind of gone. But mm-hmm. then the fourth one, it's still there. Like he still wants to go back home. So literally just the phone conversation, stringing the relationship throughout.
Yeah.
Despite, you know, a lack of communication or whatnot, yeah. it's still there.
I found that interesting too. And it was only until after I read that it's actually like happened. But I was like going, when you're in the heat of battle, do you really have time to pick up that phone and say, hey, hon, what's going on? What are you having for dinner tonight?
Yeah.
And bullets are whizzing over your head. I'm like going, that's sort of odd. Do they allow that? But yeah, apparently he was. And there was one instance where he dropped the phone and he forgot to disconnect. So I think it was in the movie, it was portrayed as a scene. She was coming out of the hospital. I think it was the hospital.
Mm-hmm. She had just found out that there was a boy.
Right. Right. And, yeah. And he dropped and she heard the bullets and she breaks down and cries. That was a pretty powerful scene too. You know, it was very well done. And so, but at first I was like going, geez, this is what you do? It's like, hey, you know, I'm in the middle of a, but apparently with the times allotted that you had, that's when he would talk to her.
Yeah, and so. I also believe that fact didn't bother me because also it's been known that Chris Kyle would spend hours just setting up shots for his next kill. So in between those times of down action, you know, that he might have time to make a nice, long, lengthy phone call to his wife.
Well, apparently in the book, it was because they were in action so frequently. It was literally the only time that he could get to try to call.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, you know, I mean, how do you meter something like that? Okay, I'm on patrol. Okay, now's a good time because it's sort of kind of quiet.
You
and
never
then
know
2 seconds later.
You never
yeah.
know.
Yeah.
So it was interesting that actually happens. Mm-hmm. And then you got to take that and think about Chris Kyle, but then there's plenty of other troops who are probably doing the same thing.
Yes, and speaking of Chris Kyle, what do we think of Bradley Cooper's performance? He gained 40 pounds of muscle in way to really just imbue the physicality of what Chris Kyle was. Because Chris Kyle was a big, tall, bulky, you know, big burlesque man. And to, you know, physically change his appearance to just, Bradley Cooper said he wanted to get to that physicality of Chris Kyle just to even start feeling like
right.
he's Chris Kyle to have his performance.
To say about Bradley Cooper, I think that, I mean, yes, physically he owned the role, I think that, but more than that, I thought his acting, watching him break down, watching him in each different scenario, I thought he did a really, really strong job. And it was just interesting to me, just reading, because he signed on to this movie first as a producer. And he had in mind for the role Chris Pratt. And this was in 2012, so this was before Guardians of the Galaxy, whatnot. And then.
And Chris Pratt was also in Zero Dark Thirty.
Mm-hmm.
So
he had in mind Chris Pratt for this. And then studios were like, nope, we want this movie and we want you to do it. So he signed on. And I think that he really did an amazing job. I don't think that I ever was pulled out feeling like he faked it. I feel like he really committed to it. He held the weight of this role, of these, of this hardship, of these kills, and I read it on him. I thought he did excellent job.
Yeah, I agree. He did aside from his training and bulking up, and it's interesting too because apparently, not that I knew Chris Kyle, but apparently, like, he wasn't a chiseled guy. He was a very burly. He was a mm-hmm. big, imposing guy. And so it wasn't so much as sculpting his body. It was just adding mass to himself, which is cool. And then he went through a dialect coach as well. And I think, again, I think he did a great job. I think it's one of his, you know, best performances, but for me it's really tough. I loved him in Silver Linings Playbook, in which he was a completely different character. Mm-hmm. In American Hustle, he was a completely different character. In here, you know, again, a completely different character. He's turned into mm-hmm. he's well above and beyond just the comedic actor that we've come to know and love from Hangover. He's turned into a good actor. Now he's having this huge hit of Elephant Man on Broadway. Yeah. So yeah, he does I don't find the nomination surprising to me.
I don't
think
either.
He did a good job.
Yeah. Academy Award nomination.
The Academy Award nomination. I don't find it surprising. And plus, I think part of it too is, you know, we'll talk about Warner Brothers' very shrewd marketing. I mean, before this movie went wide, they were blasting television, especially the football games and everything, how great Bradley Cooper was. It seemed almost intent that Warner Brothers was pushing for him to get a Best Actor nod. So when you hear things repeatedly, that's what advertising does. It sort of kind of happens and sticks, and hence I think that helped with the Academy Award nomination.
Yeah, and if you think about it, we'll get more into marketing, but if you think about it, during like football games, the very American sport for a very American film, that it just correlates with each other and it rings that message, like, this is a good movie, you're the demographic that will watch it and and love it. So, I mean, it's smart on the studio to do that.
Sure.
So I can understand that. But and then we had the small side characters that were still very much a part of every tour, which I think they did an amazing job. I mean, we saw Sam Jaeger and other great names attached to it. That really just added, like, every tour, there were different missions, and you can tell what they were. They were so different from each other.
Mm-hmm. Was I the only one? Can somebody, maybe I missed something, and so could somebody please fill in the gap? My one thing is, after this scene where he sees his brother going off, that's the last we see of the brother.
Yes.
Right?
I was just going to bring up the same thing.
Okay.
Because I thought their supporting cast was very good.
Yeah.
And the only thing I could say was that the brother was one of those things that just did not get tied up for me.
Yeah.
I didn't know what happened to him. He went home. Like, this is a real story. I'm sure he has a life. It's very important. Like, my main thing was he was so important to Bradley Cooper.
Yeah.
I just needed a question or something of him asking his wife, like, have you heard from my brother? Anything. And he just wasn't mentioned. And I was like, okay, did you give up on your brother because he was downhearted about the war? Like, what happened to him?
Yeah, I don't know. And he, and you're right. He played, he played an integral part of Chris's life, according
and
to the
Chris
movie.
Chris had become, and
right?
Why he was had the perspective he did.
And to me, anyways, he had one of the defining lines. Like, I think he was the turning point for Chris's starting to like.
Rethink
his position, like when he was like, just fuck this place. And he's like, what did you say? He's like, and then he said it louder. He goes, I said, fuck this place. And you could tell that his brother was just worn. He had seen things that were atrocious, and he was just done. He's like, what are we doing here? What's going on? And I think that one line sort of kind of was, because it came from his brother, and I wanted more too. I wanted to like
I just wanted
home,
something.
Yeah.
I wanted to know. They'd built him up so much from the beginning.
Agreed.
Because you get childhood brother. You get cowboy brother.
Right.
You get enlisted as well brother. You get he's at the wedding. And then you get, like, they're going through kind of the same life story. Like,
absolutely.
You know, they.
Slightly different places, but the same
and
path.
And different people, but, you know, encountering the same obstacles. I was like, where'd it go?
Right. Yeah, you feel the same way? Did you see something that we missed?
No, I'm right there with you. He had no conclusion, but I did like, I liked his last final scene that the audience saw, because it shows that he was, not to say the weaker man, but he was the man who got that show foreshadowed what Chris Kyle would eventually get to, that mentality that, like, he's seen things and then he's done and he just wants out and wants to
and
leave.
And you got a sense that his version of the war is a little bit different from Chris Kyle's version of the war.
And I liked how they acknowledged, like, him calling him, like, the legend and, like, you got the brotherly experience and he had a story. I didn't need to see him again. I didn't need another visual scene of him because he did have a powerful end one. I just wanted a reflection on him from Bradley Cooper's
character. Yeah, I would have thought he was going to add the barbecue.
That's all I need. I needed a line. Yeah. I needed something.
Yeah, maybe it ends up in the Blu-ray.
Or, brother bonding moments.
Something.
That, like, what they're both going through.
Yeah. Yeah, it was just an interesting thing. But
and
everybody
if they aren't
else
on good terms, like, acknowledge they're not on good terms. Anything.
Right.
Yeah. I really felt for the brotherhood that he was going through all these tours with, because every once in a while, despite how long each of them lasted, like, you still got a little bit of their lives. Like, that one guy who just got an engagement ring for
Riggle.
his, yeah, for his fiance, but then unfortunately, you know,
the Punisher guy.
Yeah, yeah. He got shot, and then then he passed away. So like, we got a little bit of each little person, and I got attached, but then I shouldn't get attached because you never know how long they were going to last.
And his passing was very interesting because it happened off camera. It happened during a procedure. So, you know, he was blinded by the shot that took him out of the war. He was still able to propose, get married, have some semblance of a life, and he went back in for a procedure. And he passed on the operating table. It wasn't that he passed in battle. He passed on the operating table. And with Chris, the way that he finds out is when he's starting, I think it was maybe his fourth tour, when he comes back and an officer came up. And so it's just interesting. And that apparently really did happen that way. That character Riggle seemed to be his closest friend because he was at least up for the first three tours, if memory serves.
Yeah, I thought that they portrayed all of the teamwork of the team very well. And they did give them each their own stories, and you knew who they were, and it didn't need to be pushed to the forefront. It was just something they did subtly and well.
Yeah,
and also, you know, just I like the reactions from everybody because, yes, they revered him as a war hero, but the fact that, like, it was just out of respect and honor for a U.S. Navy SEAL that is just doing his job, and how much he affected everyone. He saved people's lives, and by extension, you know, just they had more chances to, you know, keep going back into the war and, you know, going through all that, which was really good, especially the scene where that one man went up to him in the garage.
He's
like, you saved my life. You don't know me, but so like just how much he did.
Yeah.
I think that I think I kind of mentioned it earlier, but one of my favorite things about this movie in general is how many different significant moments of his life they put in. And the garage is a reminder of, they put in the aftermath. They put in him going home. They put him getting congratulations from a hero. They get him going to the VA hospital. They have the family. They have his almost like recovery from post-traumatic stress. They acknowledge the different funerals, the training of him, how he got there, all the tours, of course, his family, his upbringing, and his life before entering into the service. Like, they put so much of his life in this movie. And, I mean, we talked about Unbroken the other week, and that's another war hero story. And he has a lot in his life, and they really did focus on just a chunk. And I said, after watching Broken, like, well, he has just so much in his life, it's hard to give everything just time. So I understand why they made the choice to do just that chunk. And then I saw this movie, and I was like, wow, Clint Eastwood did a very good job of illustrating someone's almost entire life, and I didn't feel really gypped out of a section of it.
Yeah, and I think too, you know, part of that, you know, Clint Eastwood, you know, and I think the script, you know, the way that it told its story is that it did have an arc. You know, him coming home and him finding something to continue to protect, to continue to help, and that is by going to the VA hospital, taking some of these guys out in the shooting range and making them feel good. And that was his new calling, which, you know, which is nice. It's a nice arc because instead of going into the battlefield, he's actually still helping his brothers in arms. And I like that. And the story the story told that well. And you did get to see that side. How does one get over this post-traumatic stress? You know, there were many, I thought, parallels between this movie and The Hurt Locker, because The Hurt Locker is very similar. It's about a bomb expert who diffuses these things, and he got so wrapped up and like he became his own adrenaline junkie that at the end of that movie, this is just this wonderful scene where he's in everyday life and he can't handle it. He's just like, I'm shopping. He goes, I'm picking out what color bread to put into the basket. He goes, over there, I had meaning, I had worth, and damn, I love the excitement. And it was sad to see that character even though mm-hmm. fictitious, I believe, couldn't do it. But now in the real world, where Chris did come back and maybe find a little bit of solace in helping his brother out, and he was protecting them as a nurse, in a sense. It was good. It was, you know, and I appreciated that stuff.
Yeah, and I will say, I mean, I liked every time he went back because we saw a bit of his family. He's trying to change, trying to be acclimate back into the regular life, and he's having trouble. But my one of my problems with near the end, mm-hmm. it's a small issue, but is when finally he's starting to be that man again. Mm-hmm. And we even see in the final scene, she's like, "I'm glad you came back to me," right. And like. But my question as an audience member is just, like, how long did it take him to get back to that point? After every single time he kept coming back, he had such a hard time. Yeah. So how much time has passed in between for him to get to that?
That's a good question.
I couldn't tell you. I can't tell you what the actual answer is. You do have to make the leap yourself of that it's been a little bit of time based on the fact that, and the only kind of clues they give you to that is that he's completely moved. Which you assume takes time.
He looks different.
Mm-hmm. And as well as he has developed relationships with people at the hospital. So you assume that all this takes time and trust, and that he is allowed to take people out to shooting. So, but it's never said. It's never said. There's no anniversary. There's no. I don't really recognize the kids getting a whole lot older. Like, you don't really know. It didn't bother me too much.
I think it's a good point. It didn't factor in, but you know, it's a good, like, the, you know, there's time that may have added an extra 45 minutes to the movie.
It would have, for time constraints, and I will
have to say this movie comes in at just about 2 hours, maybe a little bit more, a little less.
Yeah.
I mean it didn't overstay its welcome for me, you know, and I felt it ended. I really felt it ended like the best way possible, and I'm glad that we didn't see Chris Kyle get murdered. And I'm glad they showed that footage, you know, and they went mm-hmm. to the Dallas Cowboys Stadium. I thought that was very good, and to me, that had more of an impact on me other than seeing him get
killed. I was so glad that they didn't include mm-hmm. that. I didn't need to that. I thought that it was just so powerful watching them. Of course, when you got to see his actual coffin with all the pins, they had kind of referred to that earlier in the movie and built up, and then it just makes such an impact when you see how many there are and how many people cared about him. I thought ending it with the footage was great, and the ending was one of the main moments that there are two moments that I really noticed the score. And the sound that they put with this mm-hmm. movie, because they end it with just, like, you know, I forget what it's called, but it's like the bugle, the funeral.
Taps.
Thank you. I was like, come on, guys. Yes. I can't remember the word. And then it just goes very quiet. And I think everyone in my audience mm-hmm. was very affected because no one really knew how to get up. Like, because so many times they wrap up movies.
Right.
It's just still and quiet. And, like, in my theater, no one really wanted to clap. Everyone was just like, okay, I'm going to now tiptoe out of this theater. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of still and kind of awkward, but I just felt like it fit the movie because I don't know how else you would have ended it. Sound-wise, I thought it was how it should have ended. The only other time I noticed the score was that when tanks were going through and I noticed the music was very much paralleling, like the sounds of gunshots and the sounds of metal rolling over, and it mm-hmm. felt it really reflected it really well. Yeah. With like this metallic sound in the score, but the ending of the score was
it worked.
So fitting.
I think it was a good way to go. I'm not sure if that was the way it was in the script, but I think it was a smart mm-hmm. way to go. It would have been to your earlier point of it would have been a hell of a lot harsher of a movie and heavier of a movie had we seen the actual murder.
I'm glad they didn't show it, because after all the deaths that we've seen from the Mustafa and him, just like all these deaths in general, and then to have the irony of it all that he's just killed the same way by enemy fire. Friendly fire. It wouldn't make this movie as impactful as it was.
I agree.
Just the ending.
Also, mm-hmm. I think you just have to think about the fact that we know his wife was so influential in the making of this, mm-hmm. and the way that this movie
played out for like her and for everyone who's affected, I felt like was very respectful. Mm-hmm. Versus like if I had known that they filmed that part and that she had to be anywhere near the filming of that scene, I would have been like, okay,
yeah,
that's yeah. too much.
Yeah, it
would have
been rough. It would have made it a much harsher. It would have made it a real, a very rough movie. And we've already been through 2 hours of, you know, what was relatively rough. Again, you're right. You know, certain war movies, especially of recent times, especially since Saving Private Ryan, you know. But then again, I would throw movies like Platoon in there as well. You know, they are not knee slapper movies. They show war at its brutalest. They show the camaraderie of these men, and you know, you don't. It's hard to get through. People live. People die. They die tragically. They die horribly. And to, in this movie, there are many deaths, and you know, it involved the killing of women. It involved in this
killing
movie
of children. That was very brutal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I'm glad they showed a little bit of it, but it was more the sound effects. Just in that, it's like using the audience's imagination is by far the worst and most effective way to get something across.
Now, what are your thoughts? Because apparently, his first kill, I guess from in the book, was a woman, but not a child. And it almost seemed like they added the child to add a little extra, drama. And then, but to me, it sort of kind of tied into the other kid towards the third quarter of the movie where he picks up the RPG. But that was a very intense scene, the way that movie opens. And I sort of kind of like how they time shift because we don't see, we open up on that scene, but we don't see him shooting anybody quite yet. Then they tell the story that leads up to that scene.
I like the nonlinear editing, and I wasn't quite sure about that. But to answer your question about the kid, I didn't mind it because I felt it set the tone for the whole movie, that this is going to impact a lot of different people in a lot of different ages. Mm-hmm. And a lot of, you know, it's going to be men, women, children, females, boys. You know, it just shows that it's anyone and everyone who's a part of this. Mm-hmm. And but I liked it also showed, you know, just Chris Kyle's emotional, that this is his job, but he's still human inside. And he's not, he's going to be affected. And it just, I feel like emotionally it set the tone for the rest of the film.
I have mixed feelings about it. I think that, to Marissa's point, that's true. It does set a tone. Also, the fact that you have the opposing viewpoints of the shots after he takes it, where you have him being, you can tell, very shaken up, and he's like, it's a kid. And then you have the guy next to him being like, yeah, you got him. Like, I thought that was interesting. I also thought it was interesting how that he then reflected on it later, with him saying that he really saw that as evil taking place because he felt like the woman slash mother, whoever referenced, was putting her kid in the way of danger. Right. And he like referenced that as like a horrible evil. And to him, that was some sort of motivation click or reason why he was doing what he was doing, because it was for what he perceived as this evil. Mm-hmm. So for those reasons, I felt that it worked for the movie, and as also for that parallel later. And then on another side of me, I was like, oh, but I didn't need to see a kid get shot, especially if a kid wasn't shot by him. I'm sure that there have been kids shot in war, and that is something that maybe people should acknowledge and realize that is happening.
Sure.
So then on that side, I'm like, okay, well, it does happen. It might not have happened in this situation, but it does happen. So why aren't we showing that? But it's like, you have mixed feeling about it, because underneath it, I'm just like, but I really just don't want to see the kid get shot.
I don't think
anyone wants to see a kid getting shot.
No, and it's what? It's not bad enough shooting a woman, but she was an adult. And I guess, you know, the way maybe justifying is not the way I looked at it, the way I perceived it is, you know, the woman was an adult who had a clear agenda as to what's doing. The kid maybe not not fully aware, like, okay, this is what I have to do.
It's what he's been taught.
Yeah.
And you listen to your parents.
Right. And the morality of it all is, you know, the kid may not know from right from wrong. Mm-hmm. And to your earlier point, too, that the horrors that things could happen in war where people are using kids as human shields or using kids, like the other rough scene was that when that guy was drilling.
The proxies.
Yeah. You know, they're being used as like human shields, and they're being used as an element for torture.
Yeah, they're pawns.
To get information out of other people. The movie didn't shy away from it, but again, I felt... How do I put it? It didn't shy away from that stuff, but again, had it been under the guise of like a Peter Berg, it would have been a little bit like, I think the way that Eastwood handled everything in this movie was not so much of an exploitation, but he did it in a way that you got the point, like, you know,
across.
Yeah.
And I mean, we unfortunately did have that death near the beginning of the film, mm-hmm. but then also we had another scene, another different tour where he was faced with the same issue. He had to almost shoot another kid who picked up that rifle. But I'm glad that one had a better ending. So there, I mean, we had the tragic beginning, but then, like, there's still hope in the end. That was, for me,
an extremely tense scene because I didn't know. Like, I didn't know what was it. Because of what happened at the beginning, it's like, oh, Jesus, that kid was going to do that. He shot a kid. And here's another kid who's around the same age, maybe 10. And he picks up the RPG and he's holding it, pointing it to where he saw that other guy. And he's like, oh, Jesus, don't make me do this again. Don't put that thing down. And then
you're at the same time worried that if he doesn't do it, then the kid's going to let it off and then it's going to be horrible.
Right.
He's going to kill his
own.
And
you know that he could pull the trigger because we saw him do it at the beginning of the movie. Mm-hmm. But it's a very interesting... It was very interesting.
I liked how they had the audience follow his thought train, like what he's going through, because it made us feel like we're going through the same thing. Mm-hmm. Like, how does one judge what to do in those situations? I mean, that's where their training comes in, mm-hmm. but like also sure. just...
Being human comes in.
Yeah, being like strung along with those real, raw human emotions. Mm-hmm. I really liked how it portrayed mm-hmm. that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting. You know, it's funny, since you say how it portrayed that, I mean, I don't know... We can go into marketing, but we should also, I guess, in a sense, talk about the controversies that this movie has been bringing up. And people talking about whether this movie is one way or the other, whether it's a supporting of war and warmongering, and whether it looks at people as like, you know, we're cheering, you know, this kind of death and carnage, or, you know, whether or not... or it's not a good message to send. And for me, this movie was sort of interesting. There were certain things that I was noticing through this. Number one, I didn't look at it as a political kind of movie so much. I didn't think, you know, Clint Eastwood, who obviously in past years has made a big stance on his politics mm-hmm. and such, fine. But in this movie, if you noticed, there was no pictures of President Bush. President Bush wasn't even... like acknowledged or mentioned. Yeah. Uh-huh. There was like very little about like the Al-Qaeda guys,
Bin Laden.
There was like and for me, to me, it was a little bit more of a humanistic kind of a movie. It wasn't I didn't look at it as a pro-war movie at all, because of the way that it was told. I found it to be more human than that. It wasn't jingoistic to me. So I just find it very interesting that all these political factions are coming and fighting and making this movie.
This is horrific. I'll say that in the essence that this movie is about a sniper in war, there's some political reference. And this being a politically charged movie, I'm going to say no, because I think you can argue from... it's kind of like however you, what opinion you go into this movie with, you're probably going to stick with your opinion. I don't think it's really trying to change your mind about how you feel. I think you can argue either way with points from the movie. If you are very against the war, you can argue that children were killed and that
this caused post-traumatic stress disorder and that people are losing limbs and that people mm-hmm. are going dealing with mental instability after and that it hurts families and that it's going on for a very long time. You cannot argue all of that. If you want to say that you're for the war, you can say that he did this with honor. He did this. There's a lot of like religious components. There is that she stays with him. There is that he has a family. There is that he ends up actually being killed by friendly fire. Like, you can take scenes from this movie and like alter them to whatever side you take, or if you are do have a side. So in that way, I'm like, I don't think this was a charged film, because I don't think it was like overweighing pressure on one side being right or wrong. It just is a movie that has war and snipers and military in it.
Yeah, and to me, see, the way I viewed this, I didn't look at this as a political movie at all. Just like Hurt Locker didn't get, I should say, because there were some years between now and when Hurt Locker came out, so I don't recall there being such a political stance, and people are coming out of the woodwork to say certain things, and I didn't look at it that way. Just like I didn't look necessarily at Fury in that way, or Saving Private Ryan in that way. This movie, I found that Clint handled it in such a way where he tried to leave as best as possible politics out of this movie, and he did. We wanted to see Chris Kyle, and he tried to make it as humanistic as possible, mm-hmm. which you have to in a war. There are atrocities. Who are you going to follow? And how does this character change? Which I think in the script, I think he changed. He, you know, and I already discussed how he became a nurse to these vets. So, I don't know. It's been very interesting.
Here's a question. Just play a little bit devil's advocate, because now you know my point. What movies... Is there any movies that come to mind for you guys that you do view as politically charged films? Like, for me, when I think of that, the first thing that comes to my mind isn't actually fictional screenplays, but it's like when you get the, like, the conspiracy films that came out about, like, 9/11. Those, to me, were politically charged films.
Well, yeah, are you talking about the Michael Moore documentaries, like Fahrenheit 9/11 and things like that? Yes, those are very politically...
Michael Moore is one of the people who have spoken out about this film.
Right. And, you know, and it's interesting because, and yes, not to skirt over what you said. I mean, right now on the top of my head, I'm trying to think of a politically charged film. I can't think of one other than movies. Look, the war movies of like the 40s, 50s, 60s, they were very jingoistic, and you know, they were rah-rah America, but that was a sign of the times. Things changed. Then when we get into the 70s, well, then things changed with movies like Coming Home, Deer Hunter, it changed a lot, but those two movies too. I mean, Coming Home nearly torpedoed Jane Fonda's career. Deer Hunter had vets protesting theaters because of embellishments that Michael Cimino put into the movie, like Russian Roulette and things like that. So, but our times changed in the 70s, where war was treated more as realistic. And then, you know, when we get into the 80s, there weren't that many war movies. Like, Platoon comes out, sort of kind of changes things.
I feel like Full Metal Jacket was another one that, like, really rocked a lot of people, too, because of that one moment where he shoots the woman.
Sure.
And there's such a long shot on him. Yeah. So, like, there's a lot of controversy there.
Sure.
That's what you get with war films. So they're going to be controversy either way.
But and don't forget though too, like with a movie like Platoon, and you know, there was an acknowledgement of Vietnam. Don't forget you had Rambo, who wins Vietnam and in First Blood Part 2. So you know, there was a lot going on. And then when war, you know, like I said, you had Platoon, you had Apocalypse Now, big Vietnam movies. And then
Born on the 4th of July.
Born on the 4th of July, another one, you know, the Oliver Stone.
What do you think?
Interview.
Yes, what movies, like, really speak to you about?
I was just saying, Born on the 4th of July, it really dealt with, you know, what happens to the soldier. He goes in with this idealistic idea of, like, hoorah, I'm going to fight the American war. And he comes back and he sees how America's treating him and they're like spitting on soldiers, which Stone doesn't show as being right, but it shows like how he kind of bought into the way America can sometimes trick you into volunteering.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Even because you're just kind of brainwashed as a kid. Like there's this great scene with Tom Berenger, also from Platoon, where he comes into the school and he kind of gives this speech. He's like, we are the best. You know, we are number one. We are the first ones on the beach. And also showed how Vietnam was a different war than World War II.
Right.
Where mm-hmm. it was so much, you know, red, you know, black and white, whereas Vietnam was a great war. So Born for July is the one that really comes to my mind. It's one of my favorite films.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and we've changed through history is like how the war movie is depicted. And we already said Saving Private Ryan again, yet again, changed the landscape. And now we come up to a movie like this. And again, I think, well, we've had Hurt Locker. We've had a Lone Survivor. We've had Zero Dark 30. You know, now we have this movie over here. And this movie, I did look at it as a character study, as a character piece. I can't recall seeing a movie about a sniper and seeing from this vantage point, you know. Although Seth Rogen tweeted because he recalled the movie which was about a sniper, and that was the third act of Inglorious Bastards. Yep. And again, I will argue to this, as soon as he said it, I got what he was saying. I didn't think it was a political comment, and people don't get the joke.
The
I think
power
we've become
of
too
Twitter.
Yes.
Well, it is the power of Twitter.
Power of speech.
Well, but it's the power of stupidity too, because he was making a joke, not trying to be political, not racking Chris Kyle's memory or anything like that. I get what he was saying, because you know, in Inglourious Basterds, he was referring a Lely Riefenstahl kind of a movie about a sniper who was pegging off American soldiers, and he was taking glee and he was becoming this hero. I saw what his parallel was. I thought, okay, that's the punchline. I get it. I wasn't offended by it, but people like jumped on him. Like, you know, have we lost our sense of humor? We're so afraid now to say anything, that anything that is said is so much weight. And with social media, there's so much weight put on everything. Mel Brooks would never have survived in this. Like, we would never have gotten Blazing Saddles in today's current landscape, because everything, because of a Twitter, everything's looked at a fine-tooth comb, and somebody will have an opinion going, oh my God, he hates American soldiers. Oh, he hates the troops. No, he wasn't. He was just making a joke. It's just a stupid joke. And I don't know. It's very interesting how polarizing American Sniper is. And
how much controversy it can create. Do you think now all this heated argument or do you think it affects this movie's chances for Academy Awards? It got nominated for 6 Academy Awards.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Sound Editing, Best Film Editing, and Best Writing Adapted Screenplay, mm-hmm. and Best Sound Mix.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Nobody directed this movie. I forgot about that.
Yeah. Clint, where did he go?
Yeah.
Big surprise.
Whether or not it's, I think that based on it's attention that it's had since the beginning, as you, Dimitri, pointed out, like they've been marketing this film as Bradley Cooper's strongest acting performance. It's done phenomenal numbers. It's really brought people into the audience. Yes, there's controversy around it. I don't think that's going to be the reason that it's not going to win something. Mm-hmm. I think if it's not going to win something, it's because there is a lot of competition.
Yeah, and that's the way it should be.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that this publicity doesn't necessarily, it doesn't help its chances. I'll say that. And I'll even go as far as saying, look, with there being 10 slots, which they rarely have ever used, I'm not surprised that it's in there. The real question is, had we still been using the original thing of the, you know, going back some years where there were 5 slots for best picture,
yeah.
would this movie make one of the 5? And that, Mike, that to me is, that's a very, for me, it's an interesting question because I've thought about it and I'm not entirely sure, as much as I liked American Sniper, would I have put it in my five for best picture had it been that time?
And for those of you who do not have your Oscar nomination list up in front of your computer right now, I have it for you. So American Sniper for best picture is up against The Imitation Game, mm-hmm. Birdman, Selma, Boyhood, The Theory of Everything, The Grand Budapest Hotel, and Whiplash. So that's what it's up against. And I agree. I don't know if it would make my top five either.
Yeah. It's not even my top five. I'm trying to ponder whether it would make the cut list if it were just five.
And I can say I don't think it would. Maybe we'll be surprised. But
I don't think it would for best picture. Definitely for sound editing and editing in general. Mm-hmm. Maybe cinematography. But for picture overall, no. I would say no. Only because, and this movie had a late push. It came out later in the year, mid-December.
It came out in December 25th.
Yeah, so late December, which is really, not a lot of time to have a lot of people watch this film and get nominated and get scrutinized as much as the other films who, Whiplash and Imitation Game, they've been out for months already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's interesting, too, because I could see what Warner Brothers was trying to do. It was about a year ago. We'd have to look up the date, but it was about a year ago that we were talking about Lone Survivor. Yeah. It was about a year ago. And Lone Survivor, Universal released it in a very similar pattern. And they did release it on Christmas Day. They had a very limited. They were trying to go for some semblance of Oscar nom. They were trying to push Mark Wahlberg. It didn't get that surge. However, when Lone Survivor came out, it did exceed the expectations of box office. It did very well the time that it came in. Not like American Sniper.
Which broke records.
Nobody expected American Sniper to do what it did. Lone Survivor was number one when it first came, when it went wide, I should say. And then I think it was another Universal film beat it, and that was Ride Along. And that was the number one movie, and then Lone Survivor was number two. And this went on for about 3 weeks or so. But it was interesting what Lone Survivor was able to accomplish as being a war film. And I think Warner Brothers almost took a page from that book. But what they did was they really, really did push the Academy. They pushed the Academy Award thing. They pushed This Is a Great Movie after the limited release. And they did a lot of mid-country marketing.
Yeah.
Because it was a breadbasket. A lot of our vets are there. A lot of the soldiers come from the Midwest. We have
religious.
And a lot religious of the religious things. What this movie had, too. This movie had a religious
overtone to it. Family overtone.
Absolutely.
And love story.
And also, if you think about it, this film, it has Clint Eastwood and Bradley Cooper's name. They're very already in the Academy A-list scrutiny in that way. It's like, so they're known for the Academy buzz in that way. And compared to Lone Survivor, you might have had Mark Wahlberg, but that's about it.
They went out to the vets as well, but I know that Warner Brothers hired a Washington-based consulting firm called Glove Park Group, and they are basically they basically hit the Midwest, and they hit the officers. Now, here's an interesting statistic. There are at least 22 million veterans in the U.S., more than 1.5 million active duty members of the armed forces. Add to that their family members, and those numbers grow exponentially. And that's who they were really, really hitting. And they were getting that. They were targeting the marketing. We said football games.
Yep.
A better way to target this. And so this is where they overtook Universal as far as their marketing goes. Plus, when you had the Academy Awards come out, then you're able to put that into your advertising.
I was saying, besides children, who over the age of 18 or the age of 21, whatever, were you not really appealing to?
Right.
Exactly.
You were really only alienating people who couldn't see this film by its rating.
So they did a great job.
And again, another number, key indication that active duty military turned out, 37% of ticket buyers were under the age of 25. Okay. Usually high ratio for a rated R adult drama. Okay. Now, when you have people in Knoxville, Tennessee, which is, that's Regal's hometown, then you get things like Regal saying, you know, we're getting people who haven't been to the movie in 2 or 3 years to come out to go see American Sniper. Okay. Yeah. So these are people, like, you're also reaching out to people who didn't, they didn't even go to Lone Survivor, but they're coming out in droves to this. So it is very shrewd. And I've always said this about Warner Brothers, they know how to market. They don't falter often. For the most part, they're right on top. And American Sniper is proof, when you look at those grosses, that they did a very good job.
Really good job. And also the storyline appeals more to the younger, young adult male as well, because that's the age where they're getting enlisted. And they're, I believe they made a joke in the films, like, how old are you? He's older than the normal age that when you first enlist. So I can understand it appeals to that demographic.
Well, here's something else to look at, though, too. The top 10 highest grossing theaters, this is where their locations are: San Antonio, Texas, no surprise there.
Yeah.
Moore, Oklahoma, Richmond, Texas, Franklin, Tennessee, Albuquerque, New Mexico. Those are your top five. What's missing from that?
Los Angeles,
New York, Chicago, Boston, San Francisco. Your top main markets are not in those top 10 grossing theaters. In fact, you get number 6 at Paramus, New Jersey. That's not even New York. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're not talking like Manhattan. It's not until you get to number 8 in which you have the AMC Lincoln Square. That's number 8. So,
and also Chris Kyle, you know, he's from that area, and right, he lived in Texas, so everyone knew him from that area. So I can understand why those surrounding states would be more inclined to go see this film, because it was their home veteran,
right,
that, you know, was one of them.
And that's why, like, I never knew that they held that ceremony at that new Dallas Cowboys mm-hmm. stadium, which is, like, the biggest stadium in forever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you can fill that out. And again, I felt that that footage at the end was way more impactful. We talked about that. But it was very... The way that even the motorcade going down mm-hmm. and people and the support that he got, you know, look, Warner Brothers, they did it right. So whether it wins the Academy Award at this point, you know, they've got a movie that the people, A+ cinema score. I mean, the audience is really loving this movie,
yeah, really good.
Which means legs, that it's going to last for a while. So it's, you know, it's all good.
And this is a movie that doesn't really, it's kind of timeless. You can watch it at any point in the year and it would still be effective. It's mm-hmm. not like generated to one holiday.
I couldn't agree with you more. It's like any good, well, you know, a war movie should have a theme or something. And like, I could see certain schools, you know, using this as one of, like, if you're teaching war in film, this could be one of those movies that you would utilize later on down the line. So, you know, and we should talk about too that budget wise, like, this movie was $58.8 million budget wise, $95 million including prints and advertising. So that's, you know, they put in a good chunk, you know. And when you're over $128 million to date in your worldwide box office, which is fascinating to me because that means worldwide. Mostly an American war movie is not going to play that well overseas.
Typically not.
I think
you have American in the title.
Of course. But look at, you know, you got the cachet of Clint Eastwood, and Bradley Cooper is proving Cooper to be an international star mm-hmm. too.
Yeah.
So
this movie
is money well spent.
Yeah. It's doing really, really good.
It's doing very well.
And I really like the music, Sarah. You said you like the music, but I thought the music really, it felt like music, like kind of in Memorial Day weekend, kind of that we had the taps throughout, which is still effective every time you listen to it. And then, you know, just the horns and the bugles, it really felt like a veteran type of movie.
I agree. And it also had a little bit of hint of one of Clint Eastwood's favorite is jazz. There was a little bit of jazz horn going on in there as well. I thought that the music paired up with the movie quite nicely. You know, and it did help set a tone, both whether it be somber or, as you said, let's see, where they were going into town.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was a pretty intense.
And you had the
intense
tank rolling over, yeah. Mm-hmm, and the sound mm-hmm. really...
Yeah,
in a way, it really well.
Not jingoistic, mm-hmm. you know, but it was very good. You know, I thought it was a good score. Cinematography,
amazing. Also, Tom, who's done so much of Clint Eastwood's films dating back to like 2002. They're working relationship. I really like the color aspect that mm-hmm. they went through.
Sure.
But the happy family memories when they're together, especially the wedding, was so bright and vivid. And then when he goes over, it's very dull and saturated
dusty
in a way.
And, yeah.
And then every time he keeps coming back home, those home scenes, they get darker and more blue.
Mm-hmm,
and then
mm-hmm.
near the end, when he's happy again, he's back to his normal self, it's bright and vivid. And colorful, despite the fact that he died.
Yeah, and it's definitely a great widescreen kind of a scope picture to look at. It was, you know, in certain scenes, like, you got that sniper point of view.
Yeah.
And, you know, so you have this whole vista, but you got to focus on this one thing, which I thought was done well. We talked about the sandstorm scene.
I was going to say that's probably one of my favorite visual scenes, just because at first, it was taken as every kind of sandstorm does, that crazy wall. We've seen mm-hmm. sandstorms in film all the time. And I was like, okay, I'm ready for the ruckus. And it was just another obstacle. It wasn't the obstacle.
Uh-huh.
It was just another obstacle in the mix of all the shooting. I thought it was done really well. And you can't make a sandstorm subtle, but it wasn't.
It was done really well. And it led to the chaos of that scene, what you're firing mm-hmm. at. Again, I also liked what it said, because Chris Kyle gets shot, I think, in the leg or somewhere. He gets shot.
Yeah,
but
he's
hobbling, and the things that he drops are, he drops his rifle, which... call back to the beginning of the movie where his father taking him out hunting.
Don't ever drop it.
Don't ever put your rifle down on the ground. Don't ever. And then he drops his Bible,
mm-hmm.
in which, you know, that was the Bible that he stole, more or less. He stole for when he was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And he had that with him the entire time. Mm-hmm. And he's willing to, like...
Yeah.
It was almost like, I need to get out. He also left his helmet. Right.
Yeah. And I felt like, I loved that, such a simple shot. Those three things. It shows, like, these are all the qualities that make him up. Like, that's who he is.
Mm-hmm.
And he lost himself in a way. And also with the sandstorm, I just like the tension that it added to the story, because now literally everyone's on a clock. And
mm-hmm.
it just really, they use that as that time element mm-hmm. to keep things going, keep the action
But
going.
It's a time element, but it's also like what saved them.
It did, And
absolutely.
It was so effective.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I loved it.
It was very well done. And it led to the intensity of that scene. And who's going to get out? Who's, you know, who might get shot? Mm-hmm. Bullets flying everywhere. I really liked that shot a lot. And it was edited really well, too.
Yes.
We did talk about editing and the way, again, we talked about playing around with time. I thought was done very well. Because, you know, the other thing, too. So the way the movie opens...
Mm-hmm.
And then when we go back in time, we don't know if that scene is... That scene could have been towards the end of the movie, where he's like, oh, Jesus, I gotta shoot a kid? Or like, you know. But no, that's his first kill.
Yep.
I really do like how that was set up.
And they're being acknowledged for it, because it is nominated for an Oscar for film editing.
It was well done.
So and I liked how it was nonlinear for the first 20-some minutes, and then it was linear throughout.
Yeah.
And I thought it was very effective. And it wasn't abused in any way that, like, the regular person who's watching it could easily understand what's going on.
My only qualm, we brought this up earlier, I'd like to talk to the editor or Clint Eastwood. How did the brother get edited out?
Where's the brother? Come on. Put the mechanical baby out of frame.
But the pacing was good. The movie was well-paced for a two-hour movie. It had
and they fit a lot in a two-hour
movie.
It's not like...
You brought that up,
and
how
there,
much they brought
yeah,
up.
There were moments where it was still silence, especially when he's sitting in the bar and he's just...
That was
a
great scene.
Processing everything. He didn't go home. He's just time to himself. I thought that was very... very effective.
You need that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very well done. Very well done.
It was very well filmed from Clint Eastwood. Great acting from Bradley Cooper. I really like this film. I highly suggest it to people. You know, just getting the perspective of what American soldiers, Navy SEALs, anyone goes through and for our freedom. Mm-hmm. And I really applaud them.
Yeah,
it was definitely, I thought, a very, very well-made film. I'm so glad I saw it, and I'll probably see it again.
So, yeah, again, I think it's a strong film. I enjoyed it as well. It's good to see Clint Eastwood. You know, he's back and getting, you know, the high accolades. He hasn't had he hasn't quite had the run, although I sort of kind of, maybe I missed it in an article, but this is sort of kind of his third in his biography trilogy. I mean, he just did the Frankie Valli story in Jersey Boys, and before that, he did J. Edgar. And now this one's about Chris Kyle. So it's interesting that the past three movies of his have been
following people's lives.
Yeah, following people's lives, and him going on to this one. But I think he did a really good job.
I really applaud this whole film in general. It was really well made.
Yeah.
And, you know, and to props to them for getting the Academy Award nomination. I think it's well deserved.
Sure. I mean, again, in the way that the Academies are today, if you got 10 slots to fill, there's no reason why American Sniper should not be.
Last minute push, it's really doing it. It's really hitting home.
Sure.
Hitting the American home. So where can everyone keep following you to talk about great films? Dimitri?
Well, you can follow me right here, and I'm at dmovies1701 on Twitter. So that's at dmovies1701.
And Sarah, I know you don't have Twitter.
I don't have Twitter. You can follow me here. I'm around. Also, you know.
It's good because you're not square.
Box office.
You're not square.
In a circle.
You're on other Popcorn Talk.
I'm on other Popcorn Talk Network shows. I'm on Box Office Breakdown with JTE, who is in the booth. Yeah, we do that on Mondays. And I'm sometimes on AfterBuzz TV as well.
There you go. So. And you can follow me on Twitter at SerafiniTV. You can follow all of us here on Twitter at Movie Anatomy, and you can follow Popcorn Talk on YouTube at Popcorn Talk Network, and follow us on iTunes as well under the same name.
And were we live? We were live.
Yes,
today,
we
right?
are live.
Yeah, we're live without an ad.
Thank you all for listening and watching and commenting and subscribing. We love movies. That's what we do. We're going to keep talking
about
films.
Them too.
Yes, so. And you love them too. And we will see you for our next film.
Bye, all.
Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, Christian Harloff, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network. We would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.